Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce our first keynote for this evening. My great pleasure to introduce Jonathan Jones, who will also acknowledge country and deliver our first keynote. He's a member of the Wiradjuri and Gamilaroi Nations of Southeast Australia, Sydney-based artist, and he works across a range of mediums. He creates site-specific installations and interventions into space that work with local knowledge systems, are grounded in research of the historical knowledge archive, and builds on community aspirations. At the heart of Jonathan's practice is the act of collaborating, and many projects have seen him work with other artists and communities to develop major projects. In 2015, he collaborated with the Bathurst Wiradjuri and Aboriginal elders to create They Made It a Solitude and Called It Peace. It does have a beautiful Wiradjuri title, and I count my apologies to all the speakers. I cannot get my tongue around it. At Bathurst Regional Gallery. This exhibition has been remounted especially for ArtState, so please take the opportunity to visit the gallery while you're here. He is currently working with longtime collaborator Uncle Stan Grant, developing Wiradjuri Galbanya, or Wiradjuri philosophy, for a range of projects. Jonathan is an extremely busy man, and we were delighted that he agreed to make time in his schedule to deliver his opening keynote. Please welcome Jonathan Jones.
Murrin Yarran, Mujigalang, Yawindi Jonathan Jones, Baladu Radri Bulgamilori Bulgibibu. So good morning, friends. My name's Jonathan Jones. I'm Radri and Kamilaroi. Natu Banigo Gubalabu Yinjimarabu Radri Mayangalang Nurumbangu Nurumrangdi. I'd like to begin by acknowledging Radri people. Acknowledge that we're on Radri country, my country. Natu Banigu Gubalubu Yinjamarabu Walubu Wombubu. I'd also like to acknowledge the two really important features of the landscape, the Macquarie River and Mount Panorama or Walu. I'd also like to pay my respects to all the elders here today and community that have travelled all across the region to be here with us. So thank you. It's an enormous honour, if not a bit nerve-wracking, to be given this opportunity by my elders to not only deliver today's talk, but to extend their warm and extraordinary welcome from last night. So again, Mandangugu Mujigalangalang. Thank you to my elders. For those who attended last night's welcome, I think you'll agree how lucky we are to have such an amazing group here in Bathurst. They've really been a group who have stood behind me and have kind of given me inspiration for all the work I do over the years. And as such, this talk is very much dedicated to the Wiradjuri and Aboriginal Bathurst elders, to those aunts and uncles who have generously sort of always empowered me to undertake a whole number of projects. So today I wanted to touch on the cultural life and vitality that exists within our region and reflect on the conference theme, A Sense of Place. I wanted to first do this by highlighting the significance of this region and the gifts that this region have to offer. And then wrap the talk up briefly by looking at the one project that's playing. Oh wow, there you go. I didn't realise I was being transcribed there. And I should also mention too that the work has a small soundtrack, so there's no birds trapped in the building. It is the work itself. So the talk will be a bit of a crash course in local history, a bit of an artist talk, a bit of language, and a few things that have inspired me and that have kind of really kind of directed the way I work and how I come to think about place. So I hope it all makes sense. But really at the heart of what I'm trying to talk about today is Australia's inability to sort of reconcile with its Aboriginal history and have a true sense of place. I honestly believe this problem of reconciling with our true sense of place is the country's biggest failing. And it's what continues to hold us back as a nation. But if we can open our hearts to what we have here, we can truly enact some change. So first, in order to frame this talk, I thought it might be helpful to sort of think about my Wiradjuri worldview. And to do that, I thought I might look at one key word that you probably heard in the acknowledgement and in the title of this talk, which is Nurumbung. So Nurumbung is used in the same way that Aboriginal people today use the word country, so not landscape, country. And if we look at the word and break the word down, we can get a bit of an understanding. So Nurung is a Wiradjuri word for camp, place or village. We can use Nurung to describe Bathurst or any town or city. Nurung is also used to describe a bird's nest or an animal burrow, so any sort of home. The second part of the word is bung. Now, bung is a Wiradjuri suffix that we use to amplify a word. Marumbung. Marun is good, Marumbung is very good. Marumbungbung, very, very good. So similarly, when we put Nurumbung together, it really means an intensification of a camp, a good camp, a very special camp. So in many ways, it's often translated as your home country. Now, because of the conference of this exhibition, I'm presuming most of us here call our Nurumbung, or our home country, within this region. So within New South Wales, ACT, maybe some Victoria. I was going to ask for a show of hands, but I can't see a thing, unfortunately. But I'm assuming that many of us come from this. Here we go. Okay. So how many people are from this region? Yeah, so a significant group of people are from New South Wales, ACT or Victoria. Now, this region is probably best described within that sort of, and I'm probably going to ask some more questions, so maybe keep the lights on if you want. So this region is really sort of described as the southeast. It's a large sort of block of the country. Yep, how many of us really know our Nurumbung? How many of us know and really appreciate our very special camp? And how does our understanding of that camp, that very special camp, this very special place that we live, change when we start thinking about Aboriginal worldviews and the gifts that Aboriginal people have kind of enabled this entire country to have? And I guess the saddest part for me in all this is that the southeast, where we call home, this Nurumbung, is often not a region associated with Aboriginal culture, which is obviously enormously problematic, which I'll go into. But first, I thought it was, I guess, very important to sort of define the southeast, because those borders of those states isn't very helpful. But really, when we're talking about the southeast, it's a Murray-Darling catchment, the Great Dividing Range and the coastal waterways that make up that area. So the southeast is probably one of the highest concentrate for Aboriginal communities, with over 60 different nations. So that's more nations than in Europe within this southeast, in a much smaller space, each with their own unique political, social, religious systems, which have developed over countless generations, and all contributing to Australia having the world's oldest living culture. Now, we know and can show you that this is a very, very special camp, that this is a really important Nurumbung for Aboriginal people, and there's many ways we can do this. I thought I'd run through some of the ones that always knock me. So within this region, we have some of the most significant sites in the world. Not Australia, not the region, but the world. So as some of you probably know, we have the world's oldest ceremonial burial out at Lake Mungo. Now, again, this really always interests me. How many people have been out to Lake Mungo? That's pretty good. There's a handful of people here who have been to one of the world's most significant sites. Not that far away, only a few hours. Around the same age as the Burrawarrina fish traps, which are the world's oldest man-made structure. I'm guessing we've got some people here from Bury. So who's been to Bury? There's a few more hands. So again, one of the world's most significant sites. Only a few hours drive away, sitting here in our region on our doorstep, and we're all not putting our hands up. What's that about? Not far from Bree is, of course, Cuddy Springs, which is where they recovered some grindstones dating that puts Aboriginal communities in this region making bread at 32,000 years ago. This is a closed-off site, so we can't go there, but it's a significant site nonetheless. This is, of course, one of the cornerstones of Uncle Bruce Pascoe's work, Dark Emu, looking at agricultural accident. So it's a highly significant site, predating the Egyptians, more than doubling the Egyptian record of making bread. From the same site is probably one of the world's oldest ceremonial objects, something no one ever talks about. Not far from home here, up in the Blue Mountains, we have sites that date to 22,000 years, rock art sites, campsites. While the oldest surviving boomerang comes again from Werri Swamp down in South Australia, only 10,000 years old. Quite close to that is Budge Bim in Gunditjmara country, one of the biggest and most complex stoned fish arrangements in the world, which recently went onto the UNESCO World Heritage listing. Who's been to Budge Bim? What? Whoa, anyone? No one's been... Okay. Sense of place. So this massive infrastructure project is just sitting down there in Gunditjmara country and crying out for people like us to pay attention to it. This cultural cringe we have terrifies me, that we have the world's most significant sites here in this country, here on our little patch, here in our Nurrumbung. And yet, we refuse to even acknowledge them for the most part. There's something I've often talked to Uncle Bruce Pascoe about, and he often laughs that there's no archaeologist students lining up to go to rural New South Wales to do their studies. Everyone's racing overseas. So, what can we take away from this? And I'm not trying to place any blame here, but what I think we can understand out of this is that colonisation has affected us all. Colonisation isn't just affecting Aboriginal people, it's affecting non-Aboriginal people as well. We're blinded to this history, we're blinded to our heritage. That's how pervasive colonisation is. You often hear us talking about colonisation and how it derails us. It's now derailing you. Uncle Bruce has often said, you know, for Australia not to pay attention to the world's oldest living culture, then you're defying your own intelligence. And I think we've started to see some of that here today. So Southeast communities have long ancestral connections, including trade, ceremonial connections, which tie the region together. But perhaps it's the experience of colonisation that has really bound us together in new and significant ways that affects all of us. The region, along with having some of the world's most significant historical sites, is also where colonisation occurs. And of course, going hand in hand with colonisation is resistance. Of course, we're standing in Australia's first inland town, founded in 1814. It was, of course, here that a massive resistance campaign was launched with a number of key leaders, including Windradyne. Whose strength was so overwhelming that martial law was declared in 1824. So that's a government-sanctioned war declared against Wiradjuri, leading to our wholesale massacre. Now, it's important to note, as Uncle Dinawan often reminds me, that even though the Wiradjuri campaign was so strong and had the white fellas on the run, no white woman or child was harmed. But needless to say, Wiradjuri women and children were targeted in this campaign, which led Windradyne to walk to Sydney and to declare peace. So we had to negotiate those peace terms because people were engaging in war unfairly. Following this, Wiradjuri and other Aboriginal groups in the southeast were hit with a second wave of smallpox, which sort of hit in this area around 1829 to 1831, known locally as Tana Tana. Smallpox ripped through the population when combined with the military campaigns, the displacement from land and our resources, and other diseases. We were sort of left on our knees. But one of the most significant stories comes from this critical moment, a story that has often inspired me, which is not far from here, just up in Wellington. It was noted that elders and community came together, and instead of giving up at this terrible moment of despair, they wrote new songs and they performed new dances to try and combat this terrible foe. So they used their creativity to combat this unknown kind of force that was ripping through the community. This extraordinary act of creativity is something that is, extraordinary acts of creativity can often be seen as ways of defying colonisation and oppression. And as a result, the Southeast is home to the first Aboriginal art movements. Yes, indeed, it needs to be remembered and stressed that the first Aboriginal art movements comes from the Southeast. Just over the mountains, not far from here in Sydney, on the banks of Botany Bay, is of course the community of La Perouse, the first urban Aboriginal community. Coming out of that community, of course, is one of the first art movements. We see there the senior men carving, producing extraordinary carving works, decorating them with burning in, and the aunts working with shells, producing extraordinary shell work, which has continued today with people like Aunty Esme Timbury. So that's one of the first art movements coming from the southeast. And of course, the southeast has also created sort of all, these extraordinary pioneers that predate everyone, predate Albert Namatjira, predate the Central Western Desert Movement, predate bark painting movement. Working in the 1800s as such artists as Wurundjeri Ngarrindjeri William Barrack, an extraordinary painter from present-day Melbourne. Tommy McRae, one of my all-time favourite artists, working on the border of New South Wales and Victoria. Or even Mickey Valladulla from the South Coast. These heroic men are the founders of the contemporary art movement, yet they are so often forgotten. They are the first to engage with European materials and to convey their cultural vision and engage with a mainstream audience. It's really, really important, I can't stress this enough, that Aboriginal art in the context that we see it today in galleries started here in our Noorumbung, in our southeast little patch. This creativity continued in the 1987. The urban Aboriginal art movement, of course, sort of crystallised with the establishment of Bumali Aboriginal Artists Cooperative happening in Sydney. This key organisation, which I was lucky enough to work with for a number of years, was conceived to create a platform for urban artists who were not being recognised. This extraordinary organisation has played a major role in defining what it is to be Aboriginal. What culture is, what it is to look Aboriginal, what it is to be Aboriginal, what things you're allowed to say and do as an Aboriginal person. This organisation has been critical within our industry defining those, defining that for us. One of the founding artists of that organisation was Wiradjuri Kamilaroi photographer and filmmaker Michael Riley, who I was really, really privileged to work with for a number of years. And Michael's work, of course, has been a huge inspiration to me, and I think you can see some of his hand, or hopefully you can see some of his hand within this work. Michael's extraordinary works found beauty in our communities. He saw strength when most people saw weakness, and through photography and film created, a new vision of what we were meant to look like from this region. And working the materials that are not associated with Aboriginal practices, which again push the boundaries of what it is to be an Aboriginal artist. Riley was a true maverick. Strength and resilience, as depicted in Michael's work, is something that has continued to define the southeast. In a region that's had the most prolonged effect of colonisation, in communities where land, children, culture, language have been stripped bare, there is always new growth. During a recent project, as mentioned, I'm lucky enough to be working with Uncle Stan Grant, and we've been working through philosophies. And Wien, or the fire philosophy, I'm just really interested in the way our culture constantly regrows and comes back stronger and stronger. And this resistance and revival can be seen in one of his sort of champion kind of projects, which is winning the revival of language. Now, Uncle Stan is just one of many language holders who has been part of this extraordinary movement. But for Wiradjuri, it was only in the 1980s that non-Indigenous academic and researcher Peter Reid announced that there were no Wiradjuri speakers left. Alas, he probably didn't speak with Uncle Stan. Uncle Stan was probably on the road, going to every Wiradjuri town, teaching anyone who wanted to learn. And from that point, a number of communities have taken that language, that seed that Uncle's planted, into some extraordinary directions. In parks, a group of dedicated leaders like Uncle Jeff Anderson and Lionel Lovett took the languages into the schools and sort of started in earnest around 2006. By 2016, so just 10 years after a lot of hard work, and I should also say just before the RAMS funding changed everything, Parks was teaching Wiradjuri to every school child in every school. Is there anyone from Parks here? Yes? Oh, that's good. Oh, sorry. So I can't see. You're sitting in a very dark patch. This is an extraordinary community. So as I said, in 2016, everyone was... school kids were learning Wiradjuri. 1,000 school kids a year were learning Wiradjuri. 1,000 school kids in a community of 10,000 people. So that's a tenth of the population learning the language of their Murrumbung, learning the tongue of their mother country where they stood. This is only comparable to Aotearoa, New Zealand. And the demographics of Wiradjuri population is, not comparable at all. Uncle Jeff and Lionel, or Mr. Lovett, have often talked about the massive change in the school environment that this language was able to bring. They saw a huge reduction in bullying and greater learning across the board. And it really needs to be stressed that this isn't just Koori kids. That's across the board. There was a marked improvement in social cohesion and the way that everyone was learning. So this process of learning your Nurumbung saw dramatic effect within the schools. I was lucky enough to work with the mob. I've worked with a number of projects now at Parks, and it is truly a remarkable story and something which I think we should be celebrating more. Sadly, since the RAMS funding has come in, a lot of those schools have stopped being able to teach. I was even impressed that on a recent trip, a couple of weeks ago, I was out in Parks yarning with everyone, and I met some Koori parents who had gone through the program themselves. They were some of the first to go through the language program, and now they're having little ones, and they decided to actively find the schools that were still teaching Wiradjuri. And they sent their little ones to that school, to the kindy, and which was fantastic. But of course, the teachers, Mr. Lovett and Lionel, was like, oh God, but now we had to, because all these little ones were showing up with language skills. They'd been learning their language at home. So Koori kids were coming in empowered already, which was great. But of course, poor Mr. Lovett had to redesign what he was teaching. He had to build that up again. So the advanced learning of these kids was already taking effect. And you can't walk down that street without someone calling out, Yirudumarang, Mr. Anderson. It's an amazing town. So Parks and the greater Wiradjuri language story is a fantastic example of cultural revival in the face of colonisation. As we can see, stories like this right across the southeast. And these revival movements are probably best charted through our cultural practices and our art practices. For the first time in generations, people are learning their traditional skills and knowledge of their ancestors, once thought lost to the severe blows of colonisation. Weaving possum skin cloaks, dances, songs, canoes, carving, some of which we saw not last night, are just some of the cultural practices that have been woken up and are taking off in the southeast. And I know probably there's many of you in the room who have been actively part of supporting that, which is fantastic, and you should be enormously congratulated. In this way, the southeast can inspire everyone. that has experienced colonisation and the destruction of their culture. We're a shining example of how colonisation does not win. We can show everyone around the world, in a world where refugees dominate the population, that things live inside you, those stories, that culture lives inside you, and it can't be knocked out of you. You carry those things within you, which is an extremely powerful act of affirmation, and shows how special our camp is. Now, this was only ever meant to be a short introduction to the Southeast, a bit of a mixtape of my hits, all the things that I love, drawing on some of my contacts and projects to show how unique and fantastic this Murrumbung is. This very special camp has given so many gifts that are not only significant to this country, and I again, I stress, to the world. From our historic sites to the development of Aboriginal art to our abilities to withstand colonisation and create new pathways forward, these are all gifts from the Southeast and are gifts from our Murrumbung that we should cherish and celebrate. They are complex by nature. They speak to an extraordinarily entwined history that are not simple or straight-lined as our history books would like us to believe. Our history is often too hot to handle. And it's often easier to hide and ignore our histories and try and forget it. We need to relearn our histories and create new futures. So how do we do this? How do we access this complex web of knowledge and histories in a meaningful way and not continue to be a complacent within that process of colonisation? And it's really simple. You work with your local Aboriginal community. You work with your local elders, you work with your local community members, knowledge holders, to help you, to guide you through these stories. They're complex, but we've lived them. They are part of us. We're so lucky here in Bathurst to have the Rajarina Aboriginal Elders Group, who've put me on the right path a number of times. The work behind me, as mentioned, was part of a major exhibition that happened in 2015 in collaboration with the elders. There's two film components which are on at the moment at the Bathurst Regional Gallery. And this work is an example of how to start accessing and talking about these complex histories. Then my attempt at talking to my Murrumbung. As mentioned, the project was originally commissioned as part of the 2015 Bicentenary of Bathurst. Sarah from the gallery and then Richard Perham, who very generously, for the first time, handed the gallery over to one artist and one project, which was a major moment for everyone. If not a bit intimidating. So even though my family has very strong connections here in Bathurst, my first instinct was obviously to talk to my elders, many of whom I'd known since I was really young, including Uncle William. So we wanted to show that after 200 years, the landscape had changed dramatically, but the elders were steadfast. They were solid. They were full of Yinjimara, respect. And even though all these things had changed around them, they had remained. And that's what we wanted to celebrate, their Yinjimara, putting them in the centre of the work. And in doing so, these living portraits show the elders in their country and talk about the history of Bathurst as experienced by Aboriginal people. The elders are the key, as we were saying before, the elders are the keys to understanding these complex histories. Through a process of conversation and dialogue, the elders nominated specific locations for their living portraits. Most of the aunts chose down at Warrnambool on the banks of the Macquarie. Obviously, historically, this is an enormously significant site where Wiradjuri people watched the Union Jack being hoisted for the first time. And today, our ceremonial ground is down there. You can see Aunty Jill standing within that ceremonial ground. Uncle Dinawan and Uncle Millian chose on top of Walu or Mount Panorama, and in doing so started instructing me on the complexities of our Murrumbung. As many of you heard last night, Walu is a very complex site, and I should say it's a series of sites. The mountain itself, as we heard, is the embodiment of a young man known as Walu. Walu, who was killed by his brother, Gunnabulla, when they fought over a young woman. When Walu was killed, where he laid, Bayami opened up the ground and he was covered in lava that gives the mountain its shape today. Uncle Dinawan reminds us that this is a moral story about jealousy, envy, and hatred. On Walu itself, there are a number of important sites, including an initiation, a young man's initiation site. This is a site once included a stone borer ring that sat on top of the mountain near present-day McPhillamy Park. As many of you would know, borer rings are hugely significant sites, and as Uncle told us last night, Walu was a hugely significant site for people from all over. But those stones that were part of the borer ring were dismantled and destroyed, but they were eventually reused and recycled and reconstituted into a small stone cottage. And in fact, you can see that cottage behind Uncle's behind Uncle there. Today, this cottage is derelict, fenced off with cyclone fencing. Part of the reason for this is the annual car race. The uncles told me that there's no loose debris is actually allowed on the ground because these car enthusiasts, I question the term car enthusiasts, perhaps they're more drinking enthusiasts, pick up anything that's on the ground and throw it over the fence at the cars while they're watching. So Walu has been cleared of any loose debris to prevent these accidents. So in a very strange way, our ceremonial stones from our borer ring have been locked into that building. And in one way, we're very lucky that they've stayed on country. They've stayed in the site where they're meant to be. We can't dismantle the cottage. We don't know what the borer ring looked like. And even if we did, they'd be picked up and used as projectiles. Similarly, the cottage is riddled with asbestos, so it can't be used. The colonial conundrum, how do we move forward with these issues? How are our elders meant to make sense of this? I don't envy the work of our elders. This is just one example of the complex problems that they've inherited and that they have to deal with. And it's really up to us to try and support them through these complex narratives. In 2015, the elders won a tireless campaign that they've been running for decades to have the mountain dual named. And so today we're lucky enough to be able to say Walu and connect to that mountain that has always been known as Walu. In fact, I still have the text message from Uncle Bill, which had a lot of emojis in it, when we won that battle. But the battle's not over. And I'd like to leave you with this. Recently, the council has sought to have a go-kart track put up on Walu, destroying a number of important cultural sites, and again, going against the wishes of the elders who know that mountain like a family member. The elders have constantly stressed that they're not opposed to racing or race activities on Walu. In fact, they remind us that the race belongs here on the mountain. The age-old battle between two brothers, Walu and Gunnabulla, is relived every October. But today, the brothers are known as Forward and Holden. And that's a story Uncle Bill tells me. It's how those elders have actually used their cultural knowledge to make sense of that site. The site, this Nurumbung, has a predetermined our activities. We need to listen to their stories and pay respect to our Nurumbung. This is a very special camp and we need to keep it that way. In context of this, I have to say that it's really difficult to hear local council give an acknowledgement of country. Do they truly mean it? Do they truly understand their Nurumbung? Again, our role here is just to support our elders and help and listen to them. Like our Nurumbung, we need to see this work. We see this work here as a living artwork, and we're really hoping to contribute to this work by taking on more portraits, living portraits of emerging elders. I should also say, in finishing, that this work is not perfect or the way you should or could work. It's just what worked for us here in Bathurst. I can assure you, however, that in your community and in your towns and in every region there are fantastic elders, knowledge holders and community members that are more than just interested in developing a dialogue with you and in sharing their knowledge and helping us through these complex histories. The responsibility rests on us, cultural workers, curators, artists and educators, to maintain that dialogue and step up. So I wanted to finish today's talk with a quote from Uncle Bruce Pascoe from his 2007 publication, Convincing Ground, when he said, "We should relish the complexity, the depth, the length of history. We should feel a tiny bit smug that we know things people from other countries don't, things they find strange, exotic and compelling. Let's bury the stone and steel hatchets and fall in love with our country. Let's share the guiltless embrace of true love, remembering that there is a huge difference between loving your country and simply loving your lifestyle. True love doesn't rely on beaches, barbecues and sunshine." Mandangul. Thank you.
Amazing and thought-provoking was that presentation. Jonathan, thank you so much. I think you have absolutely set the tone for the conversation that we, when we're thinking about Art State and thinking about regional New South Wales, have been trying to incorporate into these conversations. A small Whitefellas token of appreciation. And look, please give Jonathan another round of applause. Thank you.